Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. It's Chinese New Year. Have you bought your lobster yet? We will explain what that means later this hour. Also, we learned that whatever the Oscar voters think about the movie Selma, some high school students remind us that you can't really snub history. That's later this hour as well. But first, the latest White House strategy for thinking about extremism is apparently a plan not to say the word Islamic when talking about terrorists. Okay. While policymakers in Washington, D.C. focus on alternative messages to extremism as at the extremist summit in Washington, D.C., ISIS, the self-described throwback to the Middle Ages, this distorted version of Islam invented by armed terrorists, ISIS advances across the Middle East into Libya and parts of Egypt. From the rubble of Aleppo to the violence of Fallujah, this land was made for who or what? Catchy little tune there. What is it, actually, that ISIS is all about? ISIS Nation, a territory as big as Jordan. What's it like to actually live there? How would it actually function? Joining us now is Torbjørn Soltvedt, who's a principal analyst for Middle East and North Africa at Verex Maplecroft, a risk analysis group in the UK. Torbjørn, welcome.
Thank you.
So if you're just a citizen in this territory in between Syria and Iraq, or composed of Syria and Iraq, and try to keep your head down and just basically get by, what is your life like, as far as we can gather at this point, under ISIS?
Yeah, from what we can gather, the main thing really is that it's getting increasingly worse for people living under the Islamic State. A very good example is the city of Raqqa in Syria, a city of about 200,000 people or so. And this is really the first city where the Islamic State was able to establish full control. So it gives us a good view of how the Islamic State would like to run a city and to what extent it is able to do so. And what is becoming increasingly clear is that the people who are living in Raqqa and in other cities under the control of the Islamic State is that they are really struggling to provide basic services. Electricity is down to maybe an hour a day or perhaps less. Water quality is deteriorating. People are living under severe repression and extreme reprisals, which is the primary form in which the Islamic State, you know, enforces its control and manages to stay in control. So whereas the group initially was doing sort of programs that were less controversial, perhaps providing bread at cut prices, providing fuel at cheaper prices, once it then goes on to try and really sort of govern a city, then that's where it starts to struggle, because it doesn't have the required personnel, the required technical people to run a modern city.
And it sounds like, from what you're saying, the experience of Raqqa teaches us that people who are responsible for the infrastructure, like electricity, they flee in the face of control by ISIS. What about What about people in the markets selling produce, or pharmacists, those sorts of people?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. A lot of these people, of course, have fled as well. If they can, other people, then they have to stay. I mean, this is where they live. This is where they have their lives. So really, if you look at the Islamic State interference in everyday life, it's extreme. And you mentioned pharmacists. You know, for instance, in Raqqa, we've seen Islamic State enforce these sort of religious seminars, religious schools for pharmacists that they have to attend in order to be allowed to carry on operating their businesses. You know, they have to sit an exam and have to prove that they have to have sort of the required knowledge of sort of Sharia law, of Islamic law. So it's really sort of an extreme interpretation of Islamic law and an extreme enforcement of that. So it really kind of reaches every single aspect of people's everyday lives.
We've talked a lot on this program about how ISIS is funded by oil wells that it controls in Syria and other sources, including antiquities trade, that sort of thing. Does ISIS collect taxes? And if so, how?
Absolutely. That's as the Islamic State gained a lot of territory. It had a lot of momentum back in sort of mid-2014 was when it really sort of pushed into Iraq. And you know, as part of that, and it was able to generate a lot of money as it you know, conquered new cities, Mosul in Iraq, for instance, a city of over 1 million people. You know, it imposed taxes on local people. Businesses, you know, that are allowed to operate have to pay a tax. You know, trucks and cars coming in with goods have to pay a tax. Religious minorities, you know, if they're Christians, for instance, have to pay a tax. And even, you know, seizing bank accounts. And that has also been in a way in which the Islamic State has tried to bring back some of the sort of the key personnel, engineers, doctors, trying to force them back into the running of these cities. I mean, they've seized people's bank accounts and then try to contact these people saying, if you want to see your money again, you have to return and you have to kind of carry on operating this factory, you have to carry on operating this water treatment plant. Clearly that hasn't worked, which is creating a big problem for the Islamic State.
We're talking with Torbjørn Soldevet, who's a principal analyst for Middle East and North African affairs at Verisk Maplecroft, a risk analyst group in the UK. You know, one of the things you're describing here is that they've had to set up a separate infrastructure to do some of this collection and functioning. It's very much different from the so-called caliphate under the Ottomans, where you had the Ottoman Empire basically plugging into existing village structures for collecting taxes, a much more, energy efficient and low maintenance approach. They've decided to reinvent the wheel here.
Yes, it's an interesting comparison. I mean, they talk about themselves as a state and as an Islamic state, but you know, it bears very little resemblance to you know, sort of the historic caliphate or even you know any modern state. It's a very much a sort of top-down structure of imposing rules and regulations on people. There's not much in the way of incorporating existing structures. It's bringing in quite a lot of the time foreign fighters. Yeah. In Syria, for instance, there might be Tunisians or Iraqis that are running factories, that are running businesses and overseeing the production of oil and so on. So it's really a sort of a, it's more of an occupation. And that's clearly a problem for the Islamic State. Initially, when they had a lot of momentum, they were moving around in these large convoys, almost a sort of a blitzkrieg without the air support, you know, it's quickly seizing territory. They've lost that momentum now, and they're struggling to govern these cities. So it's become an occupation force. And I think this is having a negative impact on the group's morale. And we've seen reports of people who have turned up from European countries, for instance, to join the Islamic State. And then they see that the reality is very different from what they had imagined. They see the sort of the severe repression, brutality, and also the lack of momentum at the moment. And that's had a very negative impact on the group's morale.
I'll get in trouble for saying this, but it sounds like they haven't learned the lessons of the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. They've got themselves a quagmire.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a very good comparison. I think when you look back at you know the Islamic State's ability to rapidly seize territory in Iraq, a lot of that was down to the Iraqi government's sort of marginalization of the Sunni community. So now Islamic State run the same risk, you know, as during the mid-2000s when the U.S. troop surge alongside the sort of Sunni tribal movement was able to more or less defeat or at least push back these types of group in Iraq. If you look back at Al-Qaeda in Iraq, it was more or less defeated until the conflict in Syria emerged, and the Islamic State in Iraq was then able to sort of evolve into what is today the Islamic State. But they don't seem to have learned many of those lessons, which led to their sort of initial downfall in Iraq.
In our final minute here, Torbjørn, do you think there's any chance that ISIS can really invade Iraq or Egypt and Syria and Yemen?
No, I think clearly some of the group's ambitions are, you know, are far too far-fetched. I mean, they have a presence in Egypt, in the Sinai, and that is likely to remain the case. They will be able to exploit the situation in Libya, but beyond that, I don't see any sort of major expansion. I think they are on the back foot at the moment, and I think they will have there will be enough of a challenge for them to just consolidate territory. And I think, you know, conquering more territory at this stage will be very difficult for them.
Torbjørn Soldevet is a principal analyst for Middle East and North African affairs at Verisk Maplecroft, a risk analysis group. Thanks so much, Torbjørn.
Thank you very much.
What is it like to live under the self-proclaimed Islamic State? People don't live in mosques, and public beheadings, while they get a lot of attention, don't contribute to the functioning of a government with an army trying to govern a land the size of Belgium by some estimates, and full of holes and neutral zones between contested roadways. Author and former U.S. Marine Elliot Ackerman reports on the Syrian civil war from his base in Turkey. In a recent reporting trip, he discovered first how easy it is to encounter ISIS and Al-Qaeda types working on both sides of the border, and second, to his great surprise, how similar the recruiting mission of terrorist groups is with what he remembers about first joining the U.S. Marines.
A little less than a year ago, I was working out of South Turkey, and a friend of mine who was a Syrian democratic activist during the revolution's early days, who was also doing research in southern Turkey, had been basically working on a series of reports on some of the refugee camps on the border. And so he was in a refugee camp called Açakale, and he had met a guy there who was a former al-Qaeda in Iraq fighter. So he came to me one day and he said, "Elliot, I've met a guy in Açakale camp, and I think you would have a lot in common with him." So I sort of said, "Well, okay, who is he?" And he said, "Well, he fought for al-Qaeda in Iraq, but bear with me. I think you guys had have a lot to talk about." And so the two of us talked, and we basically arranged a meeting in southern Turkey where I had lunch with this fellow who'd been for 4 years in Iraq, had been running guns and fighters across the border from Syria into Iraq and also fighting in Iraq for al-Qaeda in Iraq. It was very interesting to sit across the table for what turned into a six-hour lunch and, you know, into the early evening, two veterans of the Iraq War talking about it, that we'd fought on different sides. It's something I examine in my writing, is how even two people who fought on different sides of a conflict are defined by that. And being so defined gives you a bond that in some strange ways makes you closer to, you know, the very people you were protecting at home who didn't share those experiences.
Elliot Ackerman served five tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan. That huge commitment brought medals for valor, the Silver and Bronze Stars, and battle wounds, for which he received a Purple Heart. But it also gave him a deep insight into how conflicts are fueled by the millions of aimless young men around the world seeking purpose and finding it, as he did, fighting in war.
You know, I think to be happy, you have to have a sense of purpose. Your purpose in life brings you your happiness. And so for some people, that happiness and sense of purpose might be as simple as, you know, I work my job every day. That sends my children to school. It puts food on the table. I see my family grow. That is my purpose. It makes me happy. Well, when you go to a war and you're a young man or a woman and you're 19, 20, 21 years old, you're with oftentimes a group of people who become your closest friends. You have a mission that often, at least at the tactical ground level, is somewhat clear. You know what you're there to do. And it's a very intense and heightened sense of purpose. Like, if purpose were a drug, I would say that this is like the crystal meth of purpose. So in your 20s, you're sitting there and you are freebasing the crystal meth of purpose, and then it ends and you come home and you need to repurpose yourself. You need to find your happiness again. And I think many people look at what's afforded to them when repurposing themselves, and they look at those options, and it's not even close. It's sort of like, if war is the crystal meth, they're looking at the Coors Light, you know, the light beer of purpose for the rest of your life. And I would say that PTSD, that associated depression, is the idea that the rest of my life I'm going to be sitting on my front porch drinking light beer, and that's as close as I'm ever going to get to what I felt before. And there's a sadness that comes with that.
Decorated veteran Elliot Ackerman today finds purpose in being a father, husband, and novelist. His book Green on Blue is a daring attempt to use his experience as a soldier to see through the eyes of a young Afghan man trying to make sense of the chaos around him.
Those cultural barriers are certainly there. But what's remarkable is, you know, once you are in conflict, once you're fighting alongside anybody, those bonds transcend any type of cultural limitations that are in place. So, you know, very quickly, you know, when you're, you know, in Paktika province on the Pakistani border and the guy to your left and your right is an Afghan soldier and you're keeping each other safe, those bonds become very real and become the same as any American troops serving alongside one another.
But the title of this book is about the phenomenon in Afghanistan of Afghans killing American soldiers. So it's really referencing something that makes it hard to trust that person next to you is actually looking out for you, that they might turn on you someday.
Right. Well, so as we're talking about bonds, you know, the title of the book, Green on Blue, refers to the ubiquitous insider attacks. Green being shorthand terminology for friendly Afghan troops, blue being shorthand for American forces. One of the bonds that I started examining, particularly I felt as I left, was, you know, you have the American soldiers, you have Afghan soldiers who are all fighting alongside each other, and you've all been defined by this experience. But the other side of the coin are the people you are fighting against. And you realize they've been defined by this experience as much as you have. Mm. Like Yeats has this poem I've always loved. It's called "An Irish Airman Foresees His Death." It was written in the First World War. And the poem opens, "I know that I shall meet my fate somewhere amongst the clouds above. Those I fight, I do not hate. Those I guard, I do not love." And it sort of gets at this idea that in any conflict, the people who participate in it become defined by those events. And so I know, and in writing the book, knew out there, you know, are my adversaries from all these years who've been again, defined by the exact same circumstances I was, and who are they? And in many respects, the book is not only an examination of the Afghans I fought alongside, but it's also an examination of the people I fought against.
So this passage from your book is an echo of Yeats, in a sense. Militants accused men of being informants and beheaded them in front of their families. Americans accused men of being militants and disappeared them in the night on helicopters. The militants fought to protect us from the Americans, and the Americans fought to protect us from the militants. And being so protected, life was very dangerous. That really perfectly seems to describe the situation in Afghanistan for someone like your main character. Mm-hmm. But also it seems to describe the pointlessness of the mission in Afghanistan for the Americans.
You know, the time I spent in Afghanistan, what became very clear to me, and I think this extends to many wars, including the war in Iraq as we're seeing it play out right now, is that wars build economies around them. They go on. They start to feed themselves. And by economies, I don't necessarily mean only financial economies, although those exist too. But they're the economies of how people get established in the war. You know, many of the Afghan commanders I worked alongside, they weren't talking about the end of the war. They've been fighting for 30 years. You know, they were commanders because it gave them an elevated position within their society. They often employed people within their tribes in the ranks of the units that they led. You know, that was their position. It was what they did. Their mindset was much less akin to a field commander fighting in the Second World War in the race to Berlin, more akin to, I would say, a beat cop in any major U.S. city. So what you quickly realize is that these wars and many wars are being fought for every reason but the ending of them. And that, I think, often stands in contradiction to the classical way we as Americans think about wars.
Do American policymakers understand that at all, do you think?
I'm not certain that they do.
Reviewers have commented that your American character is a bit of a cartoon. Do you agree with that? Do you think that that was a difficult character to write because, in a sense, you might have been afraid to render them as truthfully as you saw them because they are the ones you're most familiar with, I would think?
The character – there's one American character in the novel named Mr. Jack, who is sort of a somewhat murky special operations intelligence officer who's providing a lot of the financing for the fighting that's going on. And if we look at a lot of the literature that's come out, both fiction and and memoir, nonfiction that's come out about these wars, oftentimes the Afghans exist as these somewhat cut out characters, and there's a real focus on the American experience. And so in writing the book from the perspective of the Afghan, I had to be truthful. Is how do the Afghans look at the Americans?
Interesting.
They look at us as these sort of impenetrable, somewhat clownish, one-dimensional figures who keep rotating in and out. You know, for somebody like Aziz, the young Afghan soldier in the book, whose whole life is spent fighting, he's been there for years, and the Americans rotate on 6-month rotations. So, the next 3 months it will be Mr. Jack, then it will be Mr. Bob, then it will be Mr. Joe, and they just keep coming in and out, in and out, in and out. So the choice to create that character in a framework and sort of a pastiche that is a little bit two-dimensional was a decision because I think that is true to how Aziz would see him.
Do you think to the Azizes of the world you encountered, you were Mr. Elliot at any point?
I like to think that there are a few of them who I became a real person to. But I think I would be a little bit naive if I thought in every instance – and I served as an advisor to Afghan units that were as large as 700 Afghan soldiers, and all those soldiers knew who I was because there were only a few Americans. But I don't think that with all of them I broke through and they saw me as a three-dimensional man who had a wife and two young children at home and who liked to read novels and thought the comedy of Will Ferrell was genius. I mean, I don't think they saw me in those levels of intricacies, and I oftentimes struggle to see them as the same. So I think that these barriers are real. I think we're able to transcend them. I hope that people who read the book might be able to get an insight of what the war could look like through Afghan eyes.
Elliot, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Elliot Ackerman served 5 tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan. He's the author of the new book, Green on Blue, a novel.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
There is a party, so to speak, at Stephanie Netto's house, owner of the Lobster Company. That's a wholesaler in Kennebunkport, Maine. Stephanie, welcome to The Takeaway.
Greetings, John, from snowy Maine.
Yes, and you are having a party because essentially this is a big high-demand moment for you selling Maine lobsters to the Chinese market.
It certainly is. We've been busy now for 2 weeks, and we'll be busy for another 2 weeks.
Now, how long has Maine lobster been a staple of New Year's celebrations?
About 5 years ago, there was probably no Maine lobsters in China for Chinese New Year, and now it's very popular. And my busiest year ever.
I mean, did you go over there with like a wheelbarrow and just like sell them door to door, and all of a sudden it exploded? I mean, what explains this change?
The Chinese are very fond of live seafood. We went over there in 2009 to a trade show and met a couple of customers and have developed our business over the past 5 years there.
So what does it mean for the packing, and what special things do you have to do? Is there a holiday packaging for the Chinese New Year consumer?
No, we're just responsible for making sure that the lobsters are healthy and can get to China alive. There's no special boxing or packaging because they are put back in a tank when they get to China to keep them alive. So the consumer doesn't necessarily see the package. The lobster is the package.
And do they like big ones, little ones? Is there anything special about the lobsters?
Well, that's particular to the city that they're sent to in
really?
Hong Kong. Yep. In Hong Kong, they use almost exclusively small one-pound lobsters. And only maybe 40 miles away in Guangzhou, which is used to be Canton, they prefer a 2 or 3 pound size lobster.
And so these lobsters are all getting frequent flyer miles, right? Getting over to China?
No, but I wish I was.
How do you, I mean, they're all shipped by air, right?
Yes, they're all shipped on a plane. And there's been tremendous amounts of difficulties this year with that because of all the bad weather we've had in Boston and New York.
Would you say that the harvest is abundant?
This time of year, because the water's so cold, we harvest very few lobsters because they pretty much hibernate in the winter. So all the lobsters that we're shipping now were caught mostly in December and early January, and we had to have facilities to store them over that period of time to save them for now.
So this has really transformed your business year-round in accommodating this new schedule.
Yes. I built a new facility in Canada that holds about 120,000 pounds that feeds my facility here in Maine.
And how many lobsters do you expect to ship?
For the holiday, probably 400,000 pounds.
And are your colleagues up there in Maine doing the same kind of brisk business?
Yes, there's numerous other people in both Boston and Maine and Canada that are working round the clock to get lobsters into China for the holiday.
And who's your competition? I mean, I'm assuming there was some live seafood that used to be the big, you know, sort of high-end New Year's celebration dish.
It's the Australian or New Zealand spiny lobster, which still now sell for probably 4 to 5 times the price of an American lobster. But they have very few of them. They maybe have 20% of the lobsters available that we have available. So our main lobsters, the Chinese call them Boston lobsters, are kind of filling the middle class void of a lower class, a lower price, high quality seafood item for their celebrations.
But the spinies don't have claws really, right?
You are correct.
Yeah, I mean, come on.
I know. And they kind of like ours because they kind of look like a dragon.
There you go. What's the word for lobster in Chinese? Do you know?
Long xia. Well, that's about my only Chinese
yeah,
word.
Yeah, you're right. Exactly. I wasn't gonna get you off your comfort zone there. All right, well, you have to get back to work. And Stephanie, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks, John.
Stephanie Netto is the owner of the Lobster Company, a wholesaler in Kennebunkport, Maine, who will be shipping hundreds of thousands of pounds of lobster for Chinese New Year this year.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners to get legal help, including corporate filings, legal plans featuring attorney contract review, and tax advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
History, you may have heard, gets snubbed at the Oscars.
We will not wait any longer. Give us the vote.
That's right. No more.
We're not asking, we're demanding. Give us the vote.
Selma, the movie of the 50-year-old civil rights confrontation that broke segregation's hold on the South, didn't get a lot of Oscar nominations, and its nomination for Best Picture is not expected to become a gold statue come Sunday. No matter. Entertainment reporters can argue about this issue, but as part of our coverage leading up to the award ceremony, we decided we would check in with some of this country's newest historians, social studies students. Selma's studio made free screenings available for teenagers around the United States, including 27,000 teenagers right here in New York City.
I thought the movie was really realistic, and it showed us like a more humane side of Dr. King. And so, like, I really liked it that way.
That's 13-year-old Amaya Williams, who has no living memory of the events of Selma, and so perhaps realistic isn't exactly the right word here. But for Amaya and classmate Timothy Corian, Selma the movie made for a more vivid experience of this important period of history. For instance, the portrayal of Martin Luther King Jr.
The movie really brought to life the kind of flaws he had. Like, you know, he had fears. He was a regular human being like everyone else. I think that was really great. I also liked how they showed why he was nonviolent, and like he's not just like a nonviolent person. They actually showed the reason behind it. Like, he wanted to be nonviolent to gain more support from people around the country, and I didn't know that was the reason why. So that it was a learning experience.
What surprised me the most about Selma is how realistic it really was, because it showed in Selma how it showed that not everyone agreed with Dr. Martin Luther King's methods, and how some people actually thought that it's good to be aggressive to get to demand your rights, but Martin Luther King opposed it and said, well, if you're more nonviolent, then it's easier to gain more supporters.
Eighth grader Nia Johnson really enjoyed being brought into the debates over tactics that Selma depicts. And like a lot of students who couldn't imagine having the patience not to give back what the white police in Selma were handing out, Nia says she's sure she would have kept her cool.
I think I'll be more nonviolent, because I see why nonviolence better to go, because if you're on television and people see you getting beaten and thrown around, you know, people be like, wow, this is what they're really going through. Maybe it's, you know, maybe it's right that it's time for us to support it and go try to help them.
Amaya?
Okay, so like knowing me now, like before, I would probably think that I would be on the violent part, but then knowing all this information and after seeing the movie and everything and seeing clips, like Nia said, I think I'd be more in the nonviolent part, because it does get more of a, it gets more people's attentions. Like seeing like innocent people getting tortured and everything, you'd want to join in and help more than seeing them, people just fighting. You know, you wouldn't want to be in the middle of a fight. So
it teaches you.
Yeah.
Keep your passions and emotions in check, and keep your eye, you know, keep your eye on the prize, I guess. That's always what they would say.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good lesson.
It is.
So you guys live in a time where there's an African-American president, right?
Yeah.
Johnson was definitely not an African-American president,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Did you learn anything about President Johnson in this movie? What did you think about it? Do you think you would have thought well of him or ill of him if you were back there in the 60s?
I think I would have thought more positively about him, because, like, he was really the president who, you know, was for the civil rights after JFK died, because, you know, he didn't get a chance because, you know, he was assassinated. So I think I would have been a bit for him. But after seeing the movie and seeing, like, you know, like the, like, altercation between Martin Luther King and Lyndon B. Johnson, I think maybe I'd be a little bit against him, but then I would also know, like, the laws he passed, so...
It's hard to trust, right?
Yeah.
That's sort of what the movie's about. Who do you trust?
Yeah.
What's your favorite scene, Nia?
My favorite scene in Selma is when they cross the bridge and when the sheriff attacked them, because I remember how this one guy wanted to go attack back because so many people were beaten, but then someone says for every one of them you take, they take 20 of ours. So I think that was very inspirational, because it showed that, yeah, you can go do something and you can harm others, but you have to think about the aftermath of what you do. Like, you really have to think about the consequences of what would happen if you do it.
Amaya, your favorite scene?
I think my favorite scene was the end when Dr. King was giving his speech, because it showed that, you know, hard work pays off and you don't always have to fight for some... Well, you fight, but it doesn't always have to be physical. You can reach somebody by emotion. You don't have to always reach them physically. So I thought that that was, like, the best scene in my opinion, because it showed that hard work pays off. And, like...
Although,
when he was given that speech, he didn't think he'd won at that moment. Isn't that interesting?
It really is.
It kind of makes you, I mean, you think it.
Yeah, I think it because like I'm after all of that happened and I live in this time. So, but maybe back then it was different, but.
Wow. That's something to think about. He did not think he was winning at that moment. And we all think of it so differently. How about your favorite scene?
My favorite scene was like in the beginning, you know, when the church got bombed with the four girls. They were like having a regular conversation. Then all of a sudden, like an explosion. I liked it because like it felt so real. Like it was like a real like smack in the face to what was really going on back then. Like it wasn't like sugar-coated. It was just like 1 minute is peaceful, 1 minute is just chaos. And I loved how real they made that feel.
You see a lot of racists in this movie, right?
Yeah.
What did you think of those people?
Well, in the movie, when they will call African-Americans the N-word, it made me feel like very disgusted because I don't really like when that word is used because it makes you feel kind of, you know.
No matter who's using it.
Yeah, no matter who's using it, it's still wrong in context.
Yeah, especially because people say anything nowadays. Like, you could be a regular student and then, like, people, regular kids call each other the N-word and, like, I think it's very disrespectful knowing what the people went through back then and you're still calling them that now, especially because it's your race. And, like, I don't... If you see what happened back then, it's like you're disrespecting them because they went through all of this for you to have freedom and then you're just throwing it away, basically.
Timothy, do you think seeing this film makes you wonder if we've forgotten our history?
Oh no, I don't think we've really forgotten our history because movies like this are made like every year. Like this year we had, you know, Selma. Last year we had the movie 12 Years of Slave. We've had movies like this all the time. I don't think people's really forgotten their history. I think people are like reminded by these kind of movies. So I don't think we've really forgotten it that much.
I think like we just focus on these things 1 month a year, like February, Black History Month. And I don't think it should be like a 1 month thing. I think people should remember it like always because this is what people went through to for you to have your freedom. So you should like acknowledge it at all times.
I feel like at some levels we did forget our culture and our heritage because sometimes, you know, people don't always watch Selma or 12 Years a Slave. So when you don't watch, you know, you kind of forget the background of how we got here today. But when you do watch it, you know, you're reminded of everything of how it happened. But if you just sit down in a classroom all day and you just read about it, it just gives you like the blatant stuff that everyone knows. Like there was a march on Selma, then we had a march on Washington and all that happened and there was slavery. But when you go see it and you see all these actors really portraying their part realistically, you start to actually see how it went down.
Nia Johnson, Amaya Williams, and Timothy Corian, eighth graders at MS 282 in Brooklyn, New York. Selma is nominated for two Oscars, one for Best Picture and the other for Best Original Song. From a discussion of history, tomorrow, why don't we just do pornography on the radio?
When the cues you get are strictly auditory, your imagination fills in the exact details that you need. It's theater of the mind.
No, it will not be our last show. We're going to talk about the huge business built around audio-only porn tomorrow. You can always just listen back to the show. Check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.